This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, January 13th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. On what basis did the President of the United States order the killing of a top Iranian general? Cato's Gene Healy discusses the fallout and the various legal claims of authority now emanating from the White House.
It's not exactly clear. They're supposed to... The administration gave the notice that's required under the War Powers Resolution on last Saturday, and that's supposed to include the statement of the legal authority, legislative and constitutional authority that they claim to be relying on. But that notification, somewhat unusually, was classified. The document is available only to Congress. So even the legal theory in that document is it's kind of on a need-to-know basis, and we, the public, don't need to know right now. To the extent they've made any public argument about it, last week, the president's national security advisor at a press conference did some gesticulating in the direction of, he mentioned the 2002 AUMF, that's the authorization for the use of military force that was passed by Congress before the Iraq War. Did some hand waving toward the president's, quote, constitutional authorities as commander in chief to defend our nation. It's not clear how far they think these powers extend. On Wednesday, I put up a blog post where I asked whether the Trump administration's legal theory would allow them to order a hit on the Ayatollah, under the same theory. He's the supreme leader of Iran is in the chain, the military chain of command. In fact, there were reports that General Soleimani had a meeting set up with him to talk about responses to the U.S. in the region. So under this logic that says you can take out an enemy general, a top regime official in a country we're not at war with, could you, under the Trump theory, launch a decapitation strike at the whole Iranian regime and call it self-defense? Later that day, the day I put that blog post asking that question up, Senator Mike Lee came out of a closed-door briefing with the Trump national security officials and gave a press conference. He's an affable, mild-mannered guy. He's angry as anyone's ever seen him, saying that they actually asked that exact question to administration officials. Under this theory, can you guys put a hit out on the Ayatollah? And the officials in that briefing refused to answer the question, yes or no. So I think Mike Lee is right to be angry.
Vice President Mike Pence at a Trump rally recently said that by way of sort of justifying this strike, noted one American life was lost at the hands of Iranian-backed militia. This was a few weeks ago. Does it matter that the timing of this killing of Soleimani bore no obvious relationship to a so-called imminent attack?
Well, they've said that there have been two different stories. The Pentagon, the statement it released on the day of the drone strike, didn't mention any imminent threat, mentioned Soleimani's position in the Iranian leadership and that, we did it to increase deterrence. Secretary of State Pompeo said imminent threat that could cause the deaths of hundreds of Americans, provided no evidence for that, and has seemingly backed off of that. But the issue of imminence really matters, to legality here. Unless you embrace the John Yoo theory, which is essentially that the president gets to start wars at will, and Congress's declare war power is limited to putting the official congressional seal of approval on that in making it official under international law. Unless you buy that theory, this is being justified in part under self-defense, under the, you know, everyone agrees that the if U.S. forces come under fire, the president doesn't have to get Congress to pass a resolution in order to shoot back. But as you go up that ladder of escalation from, you know, addressing an immediate threat all the way up to, you know, a decapitation strike on the regime itself, at some point you've left the realm of self-defense and you are effectively taking acts that declare war. You know, the Constitution gives that power to Congress. The president doesn't have that power. So imminence matters in the sense that, you know, the more imminent the threat you're trying to take out is, the better argument you have that it falls within that defensive commander-in-chief power under Article 2, which, you know, they described at the Constitutional Convention, it's the power to repel sudden attacks. So if there is an actual imminent sudden attack, then, you know, that conceivably falls within the president's defensive constitutional powers. There is the additional question of, does it repel an attack to, you know, kill the commanding general? Are the plans that are supposed to be imminent just in his head? You know, if they're actually imminent plans, you know, somebody else can carry them out. So factually and legally, that story doesn't make a lot of sense. And in fact, the claim that they had intelligence on an imminent threat is, as far as we know at this point, a lie.
So what is the role of the authorizations for the use of military force that Congress passed in 2001 and 2002? Of course, the both of them were fairly broad and have been used to justify all manner of activities that have absolutely nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. In fact, some of the authorizations for the use of military force, at least the 2002 one, was used to go after people who were avowedly aligned against Al-Qaeda.
That's the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, passed 3 days after 9/11. Yeah, there are two broad authorizations at issue here. Neither one of them as broad as the administration seems to think. The 2002 AUMF, that's the one passed 17 years ago to authorize the Iraq War. In relevant part, it authorizes the president to use military force in order to, quote, defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq. So unless the president's going to get out the Sharpie that he used to change that hurricane map and change all the Q's to N's in that authorization, it's hard to see how it justifies a strike against a senior figure in the Iranian regime who's been compared to, a combination of like a CIA director and a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and maybe a vice president. It's not clear that 2002 AUMF by itself is enough to justify our continuing presence in Iraq in a war that was supposed to have ended several years ago during the Obama administration. The other relevant authorization is, the 2001 AUMF, which passed right in the wake of 9/11 and aimed at the perpetrators of 9/11. Its language is, allows military force to be used against those who authorized, committed, or aided or the 9/11 attack, or those, or harbored those who did. And Iran is not a good fit for any of those conditions. It certainly didn't authorize, commit, or aid the 9/11 attack. there have been some al-Qaeda figures before and after who've transited through Iran. But the 9/11 Commission found no evidence that Iran was aware of planning for the 9/11 attack. What you want to see to link, to have a valid link under that authorization would be the kind of relationship you had between al-Qaeda and the Taliban pre-9/11. And that's just not there. Secretary of State Pompeo and Mike Pence have been making noise about a connection between Iran and al-Qaeda in an attempt sort of to shoehorn this in to the 2001 AUMF. Under that theory, you could certainly go after, you know, 18 years later, you could certainly go after, start a war against Saudi Arabia, whose connection to 9/11 is much firmer and much clearer than Iran's ever was. And, you know, if Pompeo and Pence want to make an argument that the 2001 AUMF allows them to wage war on Saudi Arabia, I guess I'd be willing to listen to it.
The House has passed a resolution dealing with following on the president's actions with respect to Iran. That isn't expected to go anywhere. What does it specifically say?
So there's the resolution that just passed in the House, and there's a similar measure that's being considered in the Senate. It's under the War Powers Resolution. It directs the president to cease hostilities against Iran. Now, the one that just passed in the House is a concurrent resolution that doesn't have to be signed and cannot be vetoed by the president. And, you know, for that reason, it's sort of it's a statement of Congress, more or less. I think it was worth doing. It's not going to actually legally bind the president. The parallel measure in the Senate from Senator Tim Kaine is a joint resolution, which, is supposed to have the effect of law, but it has to go past the president's desk to get there, and they need a supermajority in order for it to override his veto. I think both of them are largely symbolic, but it's important symbolism, that Congress is against this. The problem is that, the situation I just described, where the president has the freedom to act, to essentially stumble or rush headlong into a war, and it takes a supermajority of Congress to rein him in, that's the Constitution turned upside down. That is not the way that the framers designed the constitutional allocation of war powers. The system for going to war is that Congress makes the decision to go from peace to war. As James Wilson said at the Pennsylvania Ratifying Convention, this system will not hurry us into war. It's calculated to guard against it because it's not going to be the power of a single man to embroil us in that kind of trouble. That's the opposite from the system that we've drifted into here. And I think the dangers where, it seems in recent days, things have calmed down from the height of, a few harrowing moments the other night when missiles were raining down on bases in Iraq with American soldiers. Tensions have, I wouldn't say cooled, but cooler heads, it looks like, may prevail. It's insane that we've staked so much on, the self-restraint of A, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and B, a president who rage tweets about potential war crimes that he's threatening. this is not the way it's supposed to work. We can do something about that last bit that we have invested so much power to embroil us in war in one person. And I think this whole episode really ought to be a wake-up call about longer-term war powers reform.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.